Okay, here we are.
And when she says we, she means we.
She means we. And I don't mean it in like an Irish way either, like small. It just means like, the we. This is kind of our
the
we
French
podcast.
Way either.
Like yes, yes. Yeah. I tried to make a pun about may we and may we, like M-A-I-S-O-U-I, like may we, may we. I tried to make a joke about that one time. It did not fly at all. Zero likes on Facebook for that one. May I have like 2 likes. And it was just, they were pity likes where someone accidentally had their finger near the thumbs up and accidentally clicked it. Have you ever done that?
I don't know. But did we jump past your usual introductory remarks, or is this just goes?
It just goes. Okay. Would you like, why don't you make some introductory remarks, since, sir, you would like to have introductory remarks? Remarks?
Welcome to this podcast. what's the name of this podcast?
Do you not recall?
Well, I know it's a spiritual, there's not a but. It's not spiritual, but not religious.
No.
It's a spiritual,
comma. There's a comma. Spiritual, yeah. Not religious.
Not religious. That's an important distinction, because some people will say spiritual, but not religious.
And I don't mean it like that, do I?
No, you don't.
No, because I think religions are cool.
Me too. I like religions.
Yeah, religions are cool, aren't they? They are.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the best things that religions have done is incorporate music into their practice, you know, to bring people together.
You're trying to create a segue, aren't you? Wow. You're so segue guy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we don't need to like lean into the segue too early.
No.
Mm-mm. You know, a really good podcast that takes this whole early banter part of the podcast even to an extreme, but is an extremely, extremely popular podcast. It's called, what's the name of it? It is And That's Why We Drink. And it's like a podcast with where half the podcast, one of the hosts does a paranormal spooky thing, and the other side they do some kind of a real crime thingy.
Know,
and they spend a lot of time up front with the banter. So I don't think you need to lean into this. I mean, I'm way older than you, and yet I have, I think, a looser
when I listen to
feel.
When I hear banter, I go skip ahead 15 seconds, skip ahead 15 seconds until I hear the guest's voice or the dialogue. Every podcast I listen, I fast forward through banter.
So that is something that a person can do. But what if a person just likes a little bit of banter to get a feel for what the hosts are all about?
You can't hit the insert banter button. No.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh my gosh, you're so right.
Right? So providing this, I get it. I am creating a podcast that is something that is like the kinds of things that I like. You like a different kind of thing with regard to that.
Right.
However, I think there is room for compromise in this, as you say, because you can just go plus five, plus five, plus five.
Yeah.
Somebody else can do that. But
we live in a pluralist society where many views are essential.
Is this another segue?
I just was interested in the many preferences being important for podcast ingestion being a wonderful thing for people.
Ingestion. You're in podcast ingestion?
Podcast ingestion, yeah.
Mm.
I
have indigestion and podcast indigestion.
You do.
Oh my God, you're just leaning in so hard on the segues.
What are you talking about?
What am I talking about? Okay, so let's introduce each other.
This is Josh, and that's Tracy.
No, I said introduce each other. You just introduced both of us.
Well, Josh, meet Tracy. Tracy, meet Josh.
It's very nice to meet mucho gusto.
Mucho gusto.
All right, fair enough. Okay, so, all right. So, we just got back, Josh and I just got back from ecstatic dance, which we have been, I think, pretty consistently. I don't think we've missed too many, if any.
I think this was the fourth one, four months.
4 months. Oh, well, that's kind of like neat then, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So that was one of our, anyway, first exciting activities that we did together was go to ecstatic dance. And So we went tonight. So we're both a little bit toasty in the brain, I think, after ecstatically dancing. And Josh also did hot yoga earlier today. I'll just say it so he doesn't have to. So he did some hot yoga. And I mean that, I don't know how hot it was. I didn't see it.
104 degrees,
which is pretty hot. And then he did ecstatic dance. So he wanted to leave earlier from ecstatic dance. I'm usually the first one that wants to leave, but he wanted to leave earlier tonight. And we had made a plan that in our frame of mind of having engaged in a creative, active activity, that we would come back and do a podcast. So ecstatic dance is the overarching principle, the overarching theme of our episode today. So, and that's where I was kind of alluding to Josh talking about embodiment and music. And I don't know if plurality was quite how that might tie in, but it probably did, because he had a look of like intentionality in his eyes. He was like, nobody's going to fast forward my podcast, said Josh. No. And Tracy says, I build in a certain amount of fast forwarding in every podcast.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, you know, if you're across from somebody and the music's playing and one person's moving kind of fast and you're kind of moving slow, if you want to be in tune, you got to find the moves that kind of work together. You know, like you and me, we were dancing tonight, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were hearing the music, right?
You're sounding very groovy right now, Josh.
We were there.
Well, talk about, talk about what does ecstatic, so first of all, you know, maybe not everybody knows what ecstatic dance is. I like to call it, it's like a rave, but without the drugs.
Right. No drugs. World beat music, typically, maybe some techno stuff, maybe some more standard danceable type music, something popular. But more or less, I define ecstatic dance. My experience with it has been you come as a clean vessel with no intoxicants. Hanging on.
Oh, no, it is. It's going. Okay, for those of you at home who thought I just told Josh to stop for no reason, it's because technology. But we're just keep blowing. We're blowing on through. Go, man. Go, man, go. I'm sorry for interrupting you.
No, that's fine. One of the things with ecstatic dance is just, it's a very much a practice of going with the flow while dancing. It's just the music is playing and people are moving, dancing in any way they want. It's popular among, what's the word? I want to use a descriptive word that doesn't pigeonhole personalities. I think more likely you could say it's popular with people who are comfortable not talking and making dance-like movements, being witnessed by other people. I said dance-like. Why did I use the word dance-like?
I don't know. Please explore.
Yeah.
Why do you think you said dance-like music? Is it possibly possible because you sometimes, especially when you're tired, you just add a lot of syllables and extra stuff onto things? No. You know, you think it was...
No, I think it has to do like with art. You know how some people can almost see everything as art,
mm-hmm.
you know, if
mm-hmm.
you have the right perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say you could see every kind of music or every kind of movement as a kind of dance. So I said dance-like because it's not necessarily dancing, but it is necessarily movement.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, it's more in, it's like improv. It has an aspect, a big aspect of improv, mm-hmm. in the sense that there aren't set moves. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
And yet, if you were to go and look at videos of ecstatic dancers, you know, YouTube videos, people move shockingly similarly. The dancers in these different, you can go to different countries and you can go forward and backward in time and even different music. And there is a dance style that when people are told, move any way you want to whatever the music does, people move in a specific way. Have you noticed that?
Mm, I haven't been looking for that. I don't know.
There is. There's a quality of movement, I think, that people default to when they're told to move any way you want.
And why do you think that is?
Really good question. Really, really good question. I've thought about this before. I think it's because when people don't have a goal in mind other than just moving, the common structure of joints, muscles, and whatnot, when you just don't give them an object, a goal, a shape, there's just a certain thing. It's kind of like a gravity. It's like the response of something falling. When you're just told to move, I think that there is a way that the human body starts to just shake and change when it's not given an instruction. It's it's almost like a white noise kind of thing. Or isn't there something in the brain called the default mode or default something network?
No. I know, I'm just kidding. I don't know. I really don't know. I'm sure that. There is. I'm sure yeah. There is. Well, okay. But I think honestly, that presupposes, like that particular hypothesis, there's something, a default mode. I'd say that's, while probably an aspect of it, that's pretty mechanistic. And it presupposes that there is no sort of ancestral memory and so forth. And I would dare say that I would hypothesize that there might be some ancestral memory or collective sense that people are dancing out. So there might be, and of course that's something, you know, that's more unprovable currently, but but I would say that maybe the reason why people find similar dance spaces is the same reason why there are archetypes that show up in non-interacting cultures over time. Like maybe it's part of the collective consciousness.
So getting more specific about the experience of dancing, you and me dancing tonight.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And even before the dance, you suggested that we make an effort to connect a little more with eye contact and attentiveness. And you even encouraged me to think about some of the ideas I have about, you know, using movement perhaps as a therapeutic process, or even a structured exercises between people where they can use a sense of intentional moving connection to get a deeper understanding of the other person, you know? And by deeper understanding, it seriously could just mean have fun with the other person. Because that is a deep understanding. To enjoy another human's company involves having some understanding beyond just being in the same room with them. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what I had noticed the other times when we had done ecstatic dance, when I was observing my own response to it, I was noticing that, I mean, my baseline, I would say my general way of operating in the world is not self-conscious. Particularly or concerned about others' opinions or judgments. It's not what's driving the bus, as it were, for me. But I found myself, and I've certainly been in settings of creative dance lots of times over the course of my life, where more than probably most people, not every day, but you know, it's been a thing. And but what I found is that the times when we have gone, I often found myself wanting to close my eyes and actually go off and dance by myself a lot. And I had a sort of a sense of enjoying it, but not wanting to interact. And it was almost like a shyness, but not exactly. Mm-hmm. It was like, I couldn't be vulnerable in movement and vulnerable interpersonally at the same time. It was like too much, like the vulnerability of moving, however I felt like it, plus interacting with another human just seemed like too much exposure.
Mm-hmm. Is this why most group dance events have an element of ritual in them? To permit that process, you know, the one that is not the individual. This just move your body kind of thing, you know, you can go inward and feel into the body. as soon as I think as there's a shared awareness, like intersubjectivity, where you share an experience, as soon as that happens, some variety of ritualization comes into play.
Well, you could, and you can call it ritual, or you could call it ceremony. Like they have similar, but something ceremonial, mm-hmm. which is like it's ritual is valuable in and of itself because yeah. it creates order and structure in the psyche and interpersonally. But if you think about it, instead of saying ritual, say ceremony, something ceremonial, it has the sense of there's a sacredness in it, mm-hmm. right?
Or, you know, sacredness. To the extent that there's a preservation of a certain variety of social interaction, you know. So ritual, I like ceremony better. As soon as you said sacred, I have less of a friendliness than you do, Tracy, I think, with matters spiritual and religious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm open to them and I like them, but I don't quite have the warm, fuzzy sort of sense of swimming in waters that are refreshing that I think you have with those concepts. Anyway, that being said, I think of the rituals and ceremonies. My brain instantly thought of sacredness when you said that. And I thought, no, wait a second. I was just talking about some sort of structure that facilitates non-self-conscious interactions among people. You know?
Okay. Well, sure. But, and when... So let's look at the idea of spiritual. The words themselves are always limited. They don't contain all that one might mean. But one way of looking at it is, for me, I doubled down on the essence inside the ghost in the machine is the only part that's really interesting to me. The machine is an expression of the ghost, not the other way around, as it were. In the sense, the consciousness, the connections, the mysterious isn't a side dish in my meal. And so I don't know, like, and I guess, and while, you know, warm fuzzy might be not a terrible way to put it, I dare say warm fuzzy makes it seem too frivolous.
Right.
And I would say that my sense of what I, you know, might call spiritual, but it could be called a zillion other things, is much more,
yeah.
It's not so warm and fuzzy as it is essential, and I mean that in both, you know, all the senses of that word.
Well, you said at one point during the evening that dance is important. I mean, just you saying the word essential reminded me of that.
Yeah, when we were sitting and we were watching, and I said dance is important. That's true. I did say that.
So, what was the? I mean, where did that come from? That comment of it being important. You know, I mean, I agree that it's important, but I just wanted to revisit that with you to see how those words came forth.
Mm-hmm. I think in that moment, and it was just something I spontaneously said. It was not the first time I've ever said it.
Yeah.
But because it's something that humans have always done. There's evidence of it being as long as we've had organizing principles mm-hmm. As humans, mm-hmm. that there has been dance. And we have lost it, at least in this culture and probably in most Western cultures, as a communal activity. And it has been reduced to just mostly, at most for most people, they only experience dance as a component of dating, of like mating rituals.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't bring up a sense of connection and community for people. It often brings up feelings of inadequacy, mm-hmm. of separation, of for many people, humiliation, all kinds of things like that. So it isn't fulfilling its natural role,
mm-hmm.
That I feel like it has for humans. And so when I see a situation like that where people are dancing, even though it is, I also see it through the eyes, kind of perhaps as the ancestors might see it, that there is a sense of disconnection in it, as if there are many different aspects of consciousness that are kind of angling about independently and not quite finding a collective connection yet. Like it, so it's like I look at it and I go, I see what they are doing. I see what we're trying here. And I see it as this expression of both vulnerability and individualism in the sense of the ecstatic dance experience that we see. I'm watching it and I'm like, this is what vulnerability and individualism look like when you mix them together in a in a not so perfect stew. And but the act of doing it is essential to break free of the limitations that society, Western society, has collectively put upon us as don't embarrass yourself, don't look weird.
That's why the environment of ecstatic dance has more to do with establishing that non-judgmental space. So the skill of ecstatic dance is, to what extent can you allow that non-judgmental attitude to be present and have a sense of freedom of movement and still enjoy other people? That's the battery on those headphones.
Yeah, it's dying a little bit, so I'll go ahead and turn it off for now. I don't think the technology... Anyway, go on.
Well, there's a... I think that in some ways there's a sadness of the modern... A sadness in the modern world's attempt to bring back and or preserve dance traditions in a culture where it's been kind of sidelined a little bit. So I see that too. I'll look at the ecstatic dance and feel a little bit like that it's not, that something's missing, that there's like, there's something like the deep structure that where if you see dance as an integral part of society, it's like people have been doing this dance for years and years. My father's father's father did this dance, you know, or something like that, right? That the absence of there being a tradition creates a certain superficialness to the dance in some ways.
Yes.
You know, which is why it's so nice, like tonight dancing with you, the connection to another human, it helps transcend the superficiality of, you know, the artificial event of ecstatic dance, you know. So I think that that's what happens when there's human connection. A lot of times there's a capacity to transcend not just sadness, but the absence of a social directive. You know how like usually when people get together, one of the ways they organize is they have some norms or something to encourage how they interact, right? And I think when two people that kind of trust and like each other, when they interact, they generate like norms and cultures like on a micro scale in that moment. So
yeah. Okay. Well, how could that occur, Josh, if it were not operating within a collective? Otherwise, it would just be two little random drops of water that aren't even in a bucket. You know, two little things that, you know, so it's like in that microcosm of us making that connection. I agree. We create some sort of, it's, you know, in that microcosm, we set the stage or set in motion some butterfly effect toward there being connection beyond us, right?
Yeah.
And so that, when I say spiritual, that's what I mean. Mm. It is the faith, as it were, because I can't prove it, so that makes it a faith, that in the microcosm the macrocosm is touched and vice versa.
Yeah, you see, these are ideas I think that you've developed and thought about a lot. And some of them don't make sense to me. I mean, the reflection of the micro in the macro, and vice versa, I get that. It could be that just my view of the experience of dance has I have a certain mindset and interpretation of the experience, especially this evening. You know, it was much more of having a desire to connect with you in more specific, intentional ways that were a combination of, you know, goals to interact with you and also just to enjoy the time. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So there was something in me that was very personal about it with you.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times in the past, my dance experience, it has to do more with going to the event to dance with the people. But this evening, it was more like, I'm going there to dance with you. I'm going to be and have this experience. And I thought, maybe I'll dance with some other people by myself. But mostly tonight, I was like, I'm going to dance with Tracy tonight. We're going to try some different things. And I even made some kind of fun suggestions, right? Like, copy me.
Yeah.
And we did
it was
these,
cool.
These fun things.
And so I'm going to... And this part of it, and we're going to come back for a part two, and we can talk about some of what we got from those different approaches. So we'll be back in a minute. Okay, we are back. I think we've solved our big, exciting thing we did today. Was figuring. I think we're pretty solid now on when it's not blinking. That's when it's recording. Mm-hmm. Do you feel pretty solid about that?
I do. It's like blinking is microphone mute. That's why I'm blinking.
Oh, I like your mnemonic device that you're using there. And then it's kind of a mnemonic device a little bit. And not blinking means it's recording. Oops. Okay, little headphones. I'm going to turn you off because you're not charged in. You're making a blink. You're making a whiny noise. So, okay. There we go. All right. So, before the break, we were talking about our own experience at Ecstatic Dance tonight and how we tried to kind of approach it differently to get more of a sense of connection. And you were talking about the different ideas you had.
Well, I came in with three main ideas from an article that I had read, believe it or not. And the three ideas are attunement through mirroring each other's movement, sense of support, like how much weight or a sense of holding is there within the experience of dance, like when you're close, are you lifting a person up or putting your weight upon them? So there's a sense of supporting each other or not supporting. And then finally, translating through space, like traveling, you know, up, down, around the room by one person initiating movement and the other person kind of either following along or not following along. So using those three ideas were there. You know, and we just kind of moved together too. Outside of me with that agenda in the mind, guiding the different ways we moved, a lot of it was just us kind of flirting and moving and enjoying each other's bodies and the music and being playful. A lot of it was that. But I was, you know, analyzing and assessing while enjoying it.
Yeah. I always have an observer mind taking notes during things when I'm having fun. We're like that way.
Yeah. There's one particular body movement that you make that I want to ask you about, you know?
Hmm.
And it's
this is like a Maury Povich thing where you like bring, like you like, okay, we're going to bring Tracy out and Josh is going to ask her about her body movements.
Here she is.
And then like the crowd goes wild, but I've been in an isolation booth. So I don't even, okay, so go on. What is it,
sir? Tabitha Cat comes out. It's me. I'm
Oh, yeah, we have Tabitha Cat. She's like, Tabitha Cat. All right, I'm sorry.
So sometimes I have it in my head, like, certain movements mean certain things.
Okay, sure.
And so one movement that you make that I'm wondering what goes through your mind, because that would be the equivalent to me wanting to know what it means, at least for you, is when you arch your back, when you bend back and kind of push your chest out and you close your eyes and tilt your head back and kind of lean into my arms and I lift you up. Are you able to describe the feeling you're having when you do that? Or is it just your body's just doing that or whatever?
Well, it isn't preconceived, mm-hmm. but I would say that it's kind of like, honestly, I think it is, I'll just be completely candid. I think there's moments when I am kind of losing my balance a little bit or I'm a little bit off. And then there's this, so it has a sense of metaphor or like, symbolically, I think it's like, catch me. Do you know what I mean? That's what it means, I think, symbolically. Mm-hmm. It also is like a submissive pose, right? It's also a pose of submission. So if we were just going to analyze it psychologically or as like symbolism, mm-hmm. Which is weird to apply archetypes and symbolism on oneself, it's a little kind of awkward to do so, but I think it's a submission. It's a request for support. Mm-hmm. I'd say those are two main factors for it.
Yeah, that's kind of how I see it too, how it feels, because my impulse when you lean back is to support you, because I, looking at the way your body moves, if I just didn't do anything when you do that, I think you would fall.
Right, so it's a trust aspect too. It's like, I'm trusting you to catch me.
So I see that particular movement as one of the ways that we can request support or feel a sense of trust, and yet also have it be an act of creative expression at the same time,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I think that's where dance is especially valuable, that it'll take these things that are essential to survival and put them into a context of creative expression so that our survival, instead of becoming a struggle, becomes an art, you know. That's been something that came to my mind the other day when you were talking about trauma and how, like, when you experience something that you can't handle or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about, well, wouldn't it be cool if somehow that being able to handle it could be associated with having skills with improvisation, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right? Well, and there's schools of counseling therapy that do use that, like Gestalt practices. But if you look at it in terms of the history of society, I mean, certainly community ritual has often been used in, as I understand it, in you know, earlier cultures or in cultures, less Western cultures, the sense of the dancing it out. Like often, like the practice of dance as a community thing, it wasn't just a, yay, let's have a dance because we like to dance so much. The ceremonial aspect of it is what makes it, gives it the juice to heal. So I think that's the thing. And that's what's missing from, for instance, middle school sock hops. You know, they have less power to heal and more power to have crap you have to recover from later, trauma you have to recover from later, right? I mean, I'm exaggerating somewhat to be colorful, but not entirely.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's the ceremonial aspect of it, the fact that it is. So another way of like thinking about when I talk about quote spiritual, I mean, there is much more going on than meets the eye. Just like when you talk about like, in that, what do I mean by
that body movement?
That body movement. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not intentionally going, oh, I'm going to show submission and the desire to be held. But my body does that. And then we can very easily see. I know my cat's attacking your foot. Sorry. She loves you so much, Josh. I mean, she's the cutest cat. Let's just, come on. Oh my gosh, you're so withholding about that. Oh well, at least you don't say things you don't mean. I guess that's good. But she's the cutest cat in the whole world. And then I have to talk to baby talk. It's really awkward. Okay, bye. All right. Yeah, so I mean, in the sense that it has a healing aspect. Like if I fall back into that submissive position in a request to be held, to like catch me, I don't feel strong right now in the dance. I mean, that's kind of what you're saying. I'm off balance. I feel, and I trust you to help me. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's symbolic because it's not like even in that moment, I'm actually feeling that fully, but it must be a representation of some latent thing in me that wants healing, that wants to know, hey, am I safe with you? Right. Or else I wouldn't dance that.
Right.
Spiritual means there's so much more going on than the just objective measurement of phenomena can express or contain or measure.
Can a person be aware of all of that stuff that's going on? I mean, it can't be measured. Can an individual, though, be aware of that stuff that you're talking about that can't be measured? I mean, can it truly be experienced?
Well, yeah. I would say that by the very nature of these things, no one experiences all of it ever. Like, there's a zillion, gajillion, billion, zillions levels of stuff that you're not experiencing. Because you don't have the faculty. We don't have the faculties to see everything. I mean, the analogy I always like to use is if you look at a diagram of the light spectrum, and it's like a full spectrum, right? And it includes all of the like the different kinds of light, and then it shows the quote unquote visible spectrum, aka visible to humans. The cats decided to be super loud. Is very, very, very tiny little slice. Oh my goodness. Well, okay, listeners at home, I hope you have a cat also, and your cat can, and my cat can do this right now together. So, so there's this tiny little, so we call it the quote visible spectrum, which is itself a sort of speciesism, isn't it? It's a sort of, it's like, it doesn't say visible, on the little thing, it doesn't say visible to humans. It says visible spectrum as if none of the rest of it is potentially visible. But in fact, some animals do see different things on that spectrum than we do. And then there's some that no animals can see, but that light is actually here right now, even though we can't see it.
Yeah.
It isn't less here.
It is. It's not seen by our eyes, but it's still experienced. Our bodies still experience it.
Yeah, yeah. But you are. But that's a leap of faith to some extent for you to believe that, or it's based on, you know, we know that X-rays. If you do X-rays at people, you'll be able to take a picture of their bones. We know that, but that was true. Even before people figured out X-rays.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wouldn't have thought that X-rays existed, that I was experiencing X-rays without that scientific feedback, you know, that said, guess what? There's X-rays and there's other radiation that's zooming around and it's going through your body and you can't see it. So I thought it wasn't there, you know?
Right.
So that objective measure gave me an awareness of something that is part of my experience, and I just don't have it with my eyes. Another thing to consider too is with, and this is, I know this is diverging a little bit from the dancing thing, is that our bodies still have the experience of that unseen like wavelength, you know, like the molecules in our body, the light waves hit it and they react, you know, mm-hmm. our skin gets burned and all of this. Mm-hmm. So these things that we don't like perceive, say with our vision, they still are like affecting us. There's still consequences of the unseen and unperceived. You know, I've thought about this in relation to some of your like ability to work with energy, that you, and I thought about like, well, I'm not psychic or something like that. And then I had this thought that, you know, maybe it's a little bit like, I just don't have the eyes to see it. My body is still working with it. I'm mm-hmm. still responding to it. Mm-hmm. I might even be manipulating it for all mm-hmm. I know.
Interacting with it, for sure.
Interacting with it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Absolutely. So yeah, I get what you're saying. And honestly, I appreciate the perspective of basically healthy agnosticism. Which is what I think you're describing, which is I don't know. And I respect that because I think there is a lot of value to not just believing in something because you want to believe it or because someone else told you or something like that. And I would say that I'm also quite agnostic in many ways, in the sense that I don't double down on the truth of very much.
Well, what I worry about, though, is the things that I think are true or okay, and they aren't, you know?
Okay, that's a really good point. So what would be the criteria? This is the way to look at that. What would you say is the criteria for not being okay?
Sure. Well, look, if I just like free associate a little bit, the criteria for not being okay would be that over time I get a good sense that people are getting hurt or harmed, or, you know, that thing that was true was doing some damage, that mm-hmm. if it wasn't believed to be true, people would be like happier, they'd be healthier, they'd get along a little better. Mm-hmm. So that kind of thing. Where someone else might say that, well, this is the natural order of things, you know? They might say, well, this is just one of like the laws of nature, that yes, this suffering or pain is there, it's because of the way our bodies are made, you know?
Well, I think that, you know, I see, okay. That's not landing completely for me. Like basically you're saying, because what I heard you say was, I mean, I'm not disagreeing, I'm just saying it isn't quite landing. The plane's not quite landing on that for me yet. So it's like you're saying that the problem with credulity mm-hmm. would be that you could believe in something that was harmful.
Yeah.
Right. And I was agreeing that that's a reasonable concern. So then it would be, what is the criteria for something that is harmful? And you kind of pointed out something that hurts people, yeah. right? And I would say agreed on that.
There's certain experiences, I can't think of a good example. There's certain things that are, that kind of hurt a little bit, but they're also sort of good for you too, though.
Like, you know, grape nuts?
Like, grape nuts? I broke a tooth once on a grape.
That's what I'm saying. It hurts, but supposedly it's good for you.
Yeah. I was thinking a little more like something related to dancing, though, that had to do with that maybe sense of self-consciousness or vulnerability, that it can be good for you to kind of lean into a little bit. You know, some people would say, no, you know, I don't dance. Dancing's not for me. It
right.
creates a sense of self-consciousness. I can't do it or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so people will shy away from a potentially healthy experience just because it's unpleasant for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it has something to do for me with this having a sense of truth that comes through going through a period of discomfort with whether or not it's worth the experience that's required for realizing that truth. You know, to get through the part there where there's doubt, where there's, you know, kind of it's not clear, and then you kind of surrender to it, and then it becomes something kind of integral to your life, and it's no longer a matter of analysis or whatever. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, and analysis is helpful. I made a really good analogy. I think I came up with a good analogy about analysis today in a session. I said, analysis is an aspect of understanding and growth, but it isn't the biggest part of it. And I gave the analogy of if you bought an IKEA cabinet and all the parts come in a box, the analysis part of it is like the part where you get all the parts out and you go, oh, here's all the C parts and the A parts and the B parts, and here's all the little screws, and here's the little, those little weird tube shaped style, like wooden things, and you put them all, you lay them all out, and in my case you hope the cat doesn't steal any of them, and you lay them all out. That's the point of analysis. But if you just spend all your time going, oh well, I think I'd like to have the C parts over on this pile now and the D parts over here, and you keep just counting the screws, you never get a cabinet.
Right.
And once you do, no matter how many times you count the screws or pile up the C parts and the A parts in the IKEA pile, once you start putting it together, there's going to be points when you're like going, oh man, this isn't making sense. You know, it's still going to be awkward, but doubling down into the analysis of a thing is, in a way, if you stay there forever, it's just a way to stay safe from the discomfort that is inevitable if you move past it. Mm-hmm. And the consequence is you'd never get a cabinet.
Could get to be really good at analysis though, and then your dedicated job would be the analyzer, and you'd have the cabinet analyzers, and then once we had the builders would come in and do the building. So you'd have a person designated. They would not have to have any other task aside from the looking at the parts.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right, exactly. So you just have, and there is a role for that in a community. So you would just have to ask yourself, is that the role that you want to have?
Right, yeah. Well, the experience of dancing for me, there's always a level of self-consciousness that's present along with the getting lost in the moment, you know? Because analysis usually is woven into our experience. If it's not a task completion kind of thing, it's like an ongoing process that's woven in, right, to this sense of abandon, sense of emotional expression. It's almost a bit of a rudder of sorts that helps our consciousness navigate in its embodied state. You know? At least for the sake of coordination of the physical body, you know, recognizing where something else is in space, and then there's a potential to go to another place, and then knowing that when you move, there's going to be another movement there. So there is an analytical process that is kind of a real-time thing rather than, you know, a point of analysis complete, engage in next part, which is more like getting the work done.
No. Well, I think one of the things that people try to do with analysis is they try to root out all uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And so in the IKEA box cabinet analogy, that's what I'm trying to address, that no matter how much you stay in analysis, there is always a leaping off point of uncertainty, right? Think about the first moon landing, and they mathed that thing up as best they could.
Yeah.
But they still were like, oh my gosh, I hope this works.
Kind of reminds me a little bit of our relationship a little bit, you know? It's like, you ever say to yourself like, I like that. I say stuff to myself like, I really like Tracy a lot. You know, I enjoy time with her. And I'll be thinking about like where our relationship is going. I think about, you know, it's almost like the, it's like a train of thought that has to do with another person's presence in my life. So it's a very unique kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons that I enjoy the dance experience, because it allows me to have that sense of like real-time analysis of you as a person in relation to me, while not like trying to finalize you in any certain form or role in my life, you mm-hmm. know? So what does get finalized is you as a persistent interactive presence, you know, instead of like something more conceptual, you know. The in relationships, I think it's so important to move from the conceptual to the embodied, you know, especially because, you know, relationships, since they involve separate consciousnesses sort of navigating each other's shared experiences and our analytical tendencies, they can it can prevent not like the deepening of the relationship, but it can prevent that being open, that the adaptability that's required, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like when we're dancing and you initiate a movement, I have to decide how responsive to be to it, you know. And a lot of times that responsiveness really depends on like the story that's going on in my mind at that moment.
Mm. Oh yeah, it totally yeah. does. And I think the stories in our mind have an inhibitive mm-hmm. quality, which in a sense the whole concept of ecstatic dance is supposed to, in an ideal state, is supposed to be a remedy for that, because of the idea of ecstasy. The ecstatic aspect of dance is the idea of is that you basically shift into a state of consciousness where you are not analyzing, right? It's supposed to, the idea is to transcend. And I think, but it takes a while to get there. Like, I mean, there's some nights when we've gone to ecstatic dance that I was like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. And then other times when I was like, no, this was fun, but I was like, but I thought, there's so much juice available in it. And so earlier today, I requested of you, like, let's do an exercise where we stay in eye contact mm-hmm. while we do it, because I was acknowledging when I looked at my own responses that I was in previous things, because of that self-consciousness mm-hmm. of feeling like I can't be both I wasn't feeling ready to be both vulnerable in my actions and vulnerable in interaction. So I was keeping my eyes closed. I was dancing, but I was keeping my eyes closed and stuff like that. And I thought, you know, it'll be a cool thing, because I trust you, Josh, enough that I felt like I would be able to work through that if I was in eye contact with you. And then that would be, and it made a big difference.
Yeah. For me especially, because, you know, since I love you, the moving with you, the ecstatic state is very accessible, you know? Like I'm on my own dancing, it takes a little more work for that ecstatic state to build, because it's a combination of losing myself in the moment, you know, body awareness, dancing out all the different things that I may or may not like, getting used to the space. But with you there, it's much more accessible. The energy of the love and closeness that's there just makes it effortless to sink into ecstasy, you know? And it's a really sweet one too, because it's not the kind that requires extreme physical exertion. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind that requires just the right song. Mm-hmm. It's not the one.
Although I would like some of the DJ's selections. I'm not loving them, honestly, peace be with him, but I mean, I really would, and he's such a great job, but I wish, I'm not in, I have yet to be really inspired by the playlist.
Yeah, well, music is, it's kind of where I started at the beginning here, was this idea of, you know, spirituality and religions integrating music into them. And if there isn't a tradition, a solid tradition of some kind for music, then it ends up being kind of like throwing darts at a map a little bit, hoping that you'll hit somebody's dance bone. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, but some darts are a little sharper than others. But yeah, I mean, I don't mean anything bad about it. I just really do. I feel like it would be a little easier for me in some ways if something. His choices are a little bit, while I like avant-garde music, I feel like his choices are, one of the aspects of avant-garde music is that it doesn't tend to have a heartbeat type of a undercurrent. And I think in an ecstatic dance, having something that replicates the autonomic nervous system of a human being is more likely to propel you into a state of that. But you know, whatever. I mean, you know, as soon as I'm going to all the trouble to create a cool ecstatic dance community, I guess I can like do it however I want, right? So no, I really appreciate what he's doing. Okay, and we are going to I got about a minute left on this on our time for this recording, so cool. Let's pick it up again. I'm glad we got to do this today again. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I don't know why we got to Mr. Roboto. All right, sweetie. All right, let's do this again soon.
Yes.
And thank you guys for listening. Thank you, domo arigato. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.